These schoolgirls are putting on a play using puppets. A classroom of 7 and 8 year olds in light blue checkered pinafores gazes on as four of their friends from a makeshift puppet theatre tell the story of a shepherd protecting their sheep from a menacing wolf. These students live in Shafat camp on the outskirts of Jerusalem, and they're all Palestinian refugees, like their parents and grandparents before them. But from their beaming faces, you would know nothing of their precarious and sometimes difficult existence. There are more than 600 boys and girls in schools like this throughout the camp. But they are not run by any Palestinian authority, nor any Israeli one. These schools, like dozens of others here in the West Bank and hundreds in Gaza, are run by a humanitarian aid agency. It provides health care, builds and repairs roads and homes, organizes waste collection. In many ways, it looks more like a government. It even gives loans to small entrepreneurs, all on top of supplying emergency food and shelter to the impoverished and victims of war. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA for short, and which operates in Lebanon, Syria and Jordan too, has been described as a lifeline for more than 2.5 million Palestinian refugees who live in camps in Gaza and the occupied territories, the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But here, its days are numbered. The Israeli government recently passed laws effectively banning UNRWA's work, accusing it of being in league with Hamas and designating it a terror organization. A move that drew widespread international condemnation and warnings of a humanitarian catastrophe. I am Reda Elmawi, and on the documentary from the BBC World Service, I am going to find out why Israel wants to get rid of UNRWA. And as I travel around Jerusalem and the West Bank, I'll hear what a future without the aid agency might mean for Palestinians. In the same school compound as the girls, but separated by a wall, are the boys' classes.
I am Dua Al-Zurba, a teacher at Shuaifat Boys School. I have been a teacher for 20 years. I started my career here, and God willing, I'll finish it here as well. What I love most about my job is students. My sole focus is on helping them succeed.
You don't need to talk to Dua for long to get a sense of the pride she has in her work. News of the ban has been a major blow for staff, students and parents.
When we first heard the news, they were very worried. Some of the older children understood the situation, but the younger ones started to feel anxious. For me, it was the most devastating news. I'm deeply attached to the children. I love them, and they need us.
At the entrance of the camp, we come across a 9-meter-high concrete wall. The Israelis call it the security fence. The Palestinians call it the apartheid wall. On the wall here in front of me, there are drawings of men and women picking up oranges in lush green surroundings. This is a sharp contrast with the surrounding environment. The camp is heavily built up here. Every space seems to be taken up by either shops, workshops, stalls, garages. And the buildings here seem like they're leaning against each other. Established in 1965, this camp was originally intended for 500 families. There are now more than 16,000 Palestinian refugees registered here, all living in an area roughly the size of New York's Grand Central train station. As well as three schools, UNRWA runs a health center, provides immunizations, and offers mental health services. 5 minutes walk from the entrance of the camp, I meet some women who belong to a community group.
If the agency is shut down, our children's future will be destroyed. they will just end up staying at home.
And they will be exposed to things like drugs and other crimes. They will end up spending their time on the streets where they might get harassed by the Israeli army or, even worse, shot or killed. They might even be tempted to throw stones at the Israeli army.
I'm outside the UNRWA headquarters in the district of Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem. It's a sprawling complex with a big fence around it and in some parts barbed wires. UNRWA has maintained a presence here since the 1950s, but today Israel wants to confiscate the land on which the headquarters are standing now. They say it's built on a property owned by the State of Israel. I'm here to speak to Roland Friedrich, the director of UNRWA affairs in the West Bank.
We've seen repeated demonstrations that turned violent by extremists, Israeli extremists around the compound. We've seen arson attacks against the compound, various correspondences threatening UNRWA with eviction.
But this compound, like UNRWA's work here, is protected under international law. And this goes back to its foundation in the aftermath of Israel's creation in 1948, the Nakba, or catastrophe, as Palestinians call it. The agency was set up by the United Nations to help and support Palestinians displaced from their homes, initially 750,000 of them. Most thought they would go back home within a few weeks. More than 75 years later, there are 6 million Palestinian refugees registered with UNRWA across the Middle East.
If the bills are implemented, it means that UNRWA's operations in the West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, would very likely cease.
Very likely, because alongside an outright ban from what Israel considers its territory, the bills also outlaw any contact between UNRWA employees and Israeli officials. That, Roland says, will make its work in Gaza and the West Bank almost impossible because Israel controls access to these areas.
Imagine a scenario. In October, we requested coordination for roughly 260 convoys with badly needed humanitarian aid in the Gaza Strip. If you cannot secure your movement on the ground, your staff might be exposed to risk to their life. And you can only have that assurance to move if you're able to coordinate directly with Israeli military and, in some cases, civilian authorities. If that is not possible, we will not be able to move the convoys on the ground. And that would mean that in the Gaza Strip, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians would not have access to the aid that they badly need.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said Israel will work with its international partners to ensure humanitarian aid remains in Gaza. But it's a big job. UNRWA says that even before the war, more than two-thirds of the refugees in Gaza depended on this aid, and that 500,000 people have taken refuge in its school buildings turned into shelters since the war began. This, now, is the audio background to life in Gaza, at least when the bombs aren't falling.
This is the sound of the drone aircraft that we call the buzzer. Honestly, this sound is so irritating and makes it hard to focus on anything.
Jumana Ahmed lives in Khan Yunis, Gaza. She's been forced to move 6 times since the war broke out, but now shares a 2-bedroom flat with her 2 daughters and husband. They can only use one of the rooms, though. The other had its walls blown out by Israeli shelling. Israel has blocked international media from entering Gaza since the start of the war.
Hello, Jumana. I'm calling you from Jerusalem. It's not very far from Gaza, but as you know, we cannot talk face to face. How are you?
We're fine, thank God. We're trying to be fine. The situation at the moment is very difficult. The worst we have experienced since the war started. Famine has begun to spread. The crossings are closed. No food, no water. There's nothing at all. I have a little girl who needs so many things, but none of these things are available. She's 13 months old. I gave birth to her in the first week of the war.
Jumana remembers as a child getting UNRWA food parcels in Gaza every 3 months, flour, sugar, milk, lentils, rice, sometimes tuna. For many months now, she says, the flow of aid has slowed to a trickle, but still a vital one.
Honestly, we can't imagine our life without UNRWA. Who will provide us with flour after UNRWA? And where can our children learn? The whole of Gaza depends on UNRWA, especially for education and health. If these services were cut off, the situation would be catastrophic.
The worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza was cited by many of the countries and organizations that condemned Israel's anti-UNRWA laws. But for Israel, Gaza sits at the core of its desire to ban UNRWA. It alleges some of the agency's staff were involved in the Hamas attacks, in which about 1,200 people were killed and 251 taken hostage.
I'm going now to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to meet Yuli Edelstein, the chair of the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. He's one of the MPs behind the two bills banning the UNRWA.
The Knesset sits on a hilltop overlooking the sprawl of Jerusalem and surrounded by trees and gardens. Its main building is a large, squat square fronted by a long concrete piazza. Inside, the architecture is modern and abstract, like much of the art hanging on the walls. As we walk to Mr. Edelstein's office, I ask his spokesperson how involved the minister has been in the bills banning UNRWA.
He is the bill. Okay, we came to see the right person then.
Yeah.
Yuli Edelstein once challenged Benjamin Netanyahu for the leadership of Israel's ruling Likud party. He's a stern-looking man, his arms braced against the desk in front of him as we talk.
After October 7, it should be clear to everyone what had been clear to many of us before October 7. UNRWA is inextricably linked with Hamas, and it's, if I want to put it in a simple way, it's kind of part of Hamas.
The allegation that UNRWA staff actually took part in the October 7th attacks was the catalyst for Israel's legislation. In January last year, it accused 12 UNRWA employees of being involved. Many countries withdrew their funding from the agency as a result. A UN investigation followed into 19 employees in total. It found that 9 may have been involved in the attacks. Those still alive were fired. For the rest, the UN said, there was either too little or no evidence. The agency employs more than 13,000 people in Gaza. But Mr. Edelstein doesn't believe it's a case of a few bad apples.
So I can provide you long lists of names who are first-degree relatives of Hamas terrorists and their employees of UNRWA. I can remind you that one of the Hamas leaders in Lebanon, that thank God is not with us anymore, was the head of teachers' union of UNRWA schools there. So it's interesting to hear that there are 9 or 19. The situation on the ground is totally different.
Since its initial claims about October 7, Israel has suggested more than 2,000 UNRWA staff are members of Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad, both proscribed as terrorist organizations by Israel, the UK, US and others. Another separate and independent UN report, this one led by former French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna, found that Israel was yet to provide supporting evidence for these claims. The report did, though, conclude that although its staff vetting procedures were robust, UNRWA could do more to ensure neutrality and impartiality. The agency pledged to implement changes, but insists it carries out detailed reference checks on all staff.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
There's very little doubt in this country that UNRWA is not part of the solution, but rather part of the problem, raising generation after generation of Palestinians in the spirit of Israel hatred. And it's all based on this eternal refugee perception. And that's not the case, and it shouldn't be the case.
What the minister, like many Israelis, objects to is that baked into Palestinians' refugee status is the promise that at some point they can return home. Israelis reject this, saying it would overwhelm their country and threaten its existence as a Jewish state. Some Israelis, like Mr. Edelstein and Prime Minister Netanyahu, claim that UNRWA perpetuates what they call the refugee problem by allowing Palestinians to inherit their refugee status. But Palestinians are not unique here. Inherited refugee status applies to all those classed as displaced by the United Nations. A half-hour drive south of the Knesset, not far from the city of Bethlehem, is another refugee camp, the Heisha, one of the original UNRWA camps created in 1949. Its population has almost quadrupled since then, and today more than 13,000 people share a maze of small alleyways that get narrower and steeper the further inside the camp you go. I am here to meet Zohra Laham, a 59-year-old retired maths teacher who worked in UNRWA schools for more than 30 years. Born in Dehesha, she spent all her life in the camp.
I was aware of UNRWA from young age. My family's house was only about 20 meters from the UNRWA school. At the beginning of each month, there would be sort of gathering where the camp residents would assemble in front of our house to get aid, like financial assistance for the needy or food aid, which back then include flour, rice, sugar, and canned goods. In the winter, they would distribute blankets. They were black and rough to the touch. The agency used to provide hot meals every day for all the residents in a communal restaurant. Delicious foods like noodles, kofta, falafel, and labneh. It was such a warm community feeling, and those are such sweet memories. Memories that will stay with me forever.
Zohra looks back on her school years with a real sense of pride. She remembers coming first in an English competition that included dozens of other schools.
My prize was a dictionary, a pencil case, and crayons. That reward meant a lot to me. Without UNRWA schools, many children wouldn't have had the opportunity to learn. Many families couldn't afford to educate their children. After we were displaced from our villages and made refugees, education was the only capital we had left.
This is something I've been told by every Palestinian refugee I've spoken to. To them, education could be a route out of poverty, a path to a better life. Many refugees become teachers themselves, like Zohra. But this is one of the reasons Israel says it's so worried about UNRWA. It says the Palestinian influence in the agency's schools makes them a breeding ground for terrorism. Israelis have repeatedly pointed to textbooks as evidence. Approved by the Palestinian Authority, some of these include maps that do not label Israel or references to the Zionist occupation. The Colonna report on UNRWA impartiality and a separate one specifically on textbooks commissioned by the European Union, raised concerns about this issue. UNRWA says it reviews all textbooks to ensure they comply with UN values and trains teachers on how to address any problematic textbook content in the classroom.
In my 30 years as a teacher in UNRWA schools, I never saw anyone engage in political discussions or try to spread political ideas. Any such claims are completely unfounded and misplaced.
Zohra is a fierce defender of UNRWA and its schools. But of course, it's not just at schools that young people are influenced. Not far from Zohra's house is a community center not run by UNRWA called Lilac. The Youth Center for Community Development in Dehesha is a space that organizes cultural and artistic activities for young people from the camp. On the roof, there is also a space to play sports. At the moment, they're practicing boxing. Social justice, human rights, and collective action are some of the center's core values, and discussions of Palestinian history are common. A few days after leaving the occupied territories, I meet Omar Hamidat, a refugee pursuing an academic career in the UK. We talk outside the Palestinian mission to the UK in West London. Palestinians here consider it their embassy.
I came here to collect my passport, which I had renewed recently. It's a mixed feeling. I do appreciate that I have a passport and also can travel. because there are other people who have passports and can't, such as the, you know, our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
Omar came to London in 2020, aged 28. Before that, he lived in Doha, a Palestinian town just outside Haifa. But he spent a lot of time in the camp. Many of his friends were there, and for over 3 years, he studied at one of its UNRWA schools. At Lilac, Omar was able to have the discussions and learn the Palestinian history he says he couldn't at school. He became a teacher and a leader at the center.
There is a general understanding among the refugees that our education system in the UNRWA schools or in the Palestinian government or Palestinian Authority schools, it is lacking a great deal of our history. And so realizing this need, we started doing initiatives that target the schools and teach kids and read together stories that symbolizes a Palestinian refugee or speaks to the right of return.
How did this work within the framework of UNRWA? They don't allow any political activity.
It was indeed a challenge. The ones actually we were able to execute at the end of the day were in collaboration with the teachers without agreement on the formal level. And what made that easier even is that the principal and the teacher, as well as everybody involved in the school, is a refugee. So they are also concerned and they are also interested. And so we were able to sneak ourselves in and do these activities in the UNRWA school in the Haifa.
This is exactly the sort of thing Israelis say they are worried about. There was no inciting of hatred or violence, though. He says he was simply telling refugees about their people's history and rights.
But I do think that our mere existence is a threat to them. Because yes, if we know the truth and we know our history and we are confident about it, then we will act upon that.
Back at Shafat camp on the outskirts of Jerusalem, Israel's efforts to contain the perceived threat from refugees are apparent even before you go inside.
The first thing we see when we get into the camp is the large checkpoint. It has 5 lanes for vehicles and a long, narrow, caged corridor with a metal door at the end. Next to it, there is a small military bunker with a watchtower on top of it. It looks very fortified. When I get more inside the camp, I can see more explicit, more militant graffitis. I can read here, "The right sniper in the right place is better than 1,000 soldiers in the battlefield."
At the Camp Services Committee, Shafat's self-governing body, the mothers I met told me they were worried that this pent-up anger might spill onto the streets if UNRWA disappears. This was a concern also raised by Roland Friedrich, the director of UNRWA affairs in the West Bank. He's calling for these Israeli laws to be reversed.
From a practical perspective, the scale of UNRWA's operations, both in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, is so big that it is not possible, and certainly not in the time frame that is being proposed, to look into any alternatives, even if there was a willingness to do that.
Every Palestinian I've spoken to has said there is no alternative to UNRWA, that it's irreplaceable. So too have the other major aid agencies operating in the region. But if the laws go into effect at the end of January, as Israel has pledged, what's the plan B? For Mr. Friedrich, it's clear.
Under international law, the responsibility for providing services to Palestinian refugees would revert to the Israeli authorities.
Only in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, where, under international law, Israel is the occupying power. In Gaza, it's more complicated because although Israel maintains a blockade, controlling access in and out to try to stop Hamas attacks, the Strip is Palestinian land, currently governed by Hamas. Back in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, I asked Yuli Edelstein where he thinks Israel's responsibilities lie and what should happen next.
You know, it would be a very good moment for the international community to stop for a second and think, if for a change they really care about Palestinians, it's very easy to find either UN Refugee Agency or different international rescue organizations to move in with full cooperation of the Israeli government to provide assistance to the Palestinian families.
Many aid organizations said they're not up to that task. So are you willing to take up this responsibility?
If you would ask me whether we would see starving people and not help them, it's not going to happen. Definitely, we have the record on that.
This record in Gaza is hotly contested, though. Multiple aid agencies have warned of imminent famine, especially in the north, because they say Israel is not letting enough aid in. Controversially, too, the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza, allegations both men strongly reject. Israel is appealing the ICC decision and says it has channeled massive amounts of aid through crossings into Gaza, but its distribution has been hampered by inefficient operations by aid organizations on the ground and looting by Hamas and others. Israel has pledged to work with other UN organizations like UNICEF and the World Food Programme once the UNRWA ban comes into effect. The Palestinian Authority, which governs part of the West Bank, though not Gaza, which is now controlled by Hamas, told us it would only be able to step in once the refugee question was resolved. Dua Az-Zurba, the Shafat teacher I spoke to earlier, told me she would carry on until she's made to stop. Right now, that's all she and her students can do. Thank you for listening to Israel's UNRWA Ban from the BBC World Service, which was presented by me, Reda El-Mawi, and produced by Ziad Ghandour and Simon Tullet.